In this episode of Will Work for Purpose, I'll be talking about general conceptions of mental disorders given the rise in mental illness due to COVID. I felt like this would be a timely episode as many people will find themselves in the position of a therapist without any skills or techniques that therapists typically learn. So without further ado, this is the latest episode of Will Work for Purpose. Today's episode of Will Work for Purpose. Today I'd like to talk about something that I think will be beneficial for pretty much everybody given the circumstances we all find ourselves in today, and mainly like essentially what it's like to be a therapist or what it's like to provide that sort of capacity to someone. In prior generations, they didn't have formal psychotherapy. They just had like physiotherapy or just medical doctors. They just had people to intervene with their body, and they just assumed that in some capacity that would affect their mind. But by and large, they didn't treat mental issues with any sort of acuity or urgency or civility. They just locked them up and threw away the key, essentially. But now we know that people can suffer to various degrees throughout their life, and in fact, most people in their lifetime will have some sort of disorder or illness, or they'll suffer in some capacity within their mental life, you know. And especially with COVID, we've seen a major uptick in pretty much everything within the mental health domain, and anxiety, depression, suicidal tendencies, domestic abuse, violence, things like that. Or at least domestic abuse and violence, we assume, has gone up because those protective and preventative factors have been taken away from the people who typically experience it. Like, for instance, kids now no longer go to school, parents no longer go to work, so they're more likely to be exposed to their abuser for longer periods of time. Though the reported numbers of domestic abuse actually had gone down during COVID, it's likely that's due to underreporting as opposed to the numbers actually being less. But, you know, that's a bit tangential and probably for another time. But like I was saying, mental illness, mental issues, mental disorders, whatever you want to call them, neurosis, like... not only have they gone up in the time of COVID, the pandemic, but like I had mentioned before, people had struggled with them, you know, most of their life. Our era has a distinct, a distinct draw in the sense that it's gone up more now than ever. Like, it's more prevalent than ever before. People are now killing themselves at rates at which we'd never seen. Suicide is now, I believe, for people under the age of 55, it is now the third thing that's most likely to kill them, behind like accidents and like heart disease or something like that, like car accidents or just accidents in general. And so that's very troubling that we're killing ourselves at such an alarming rate. And, you know, there are a multiplicity of variables that lead into that. Like, there are lots and lots of reasons why someone might kill themselves, you know. And for many of them, you know, it's not entirely unreasonable. You know, I'm not condoning suicide in any, you know, sense. I'm quite strongly against it for obvious reasons. But, you know, for instance, I've been reading a lot of Viktor Frankl. I just finished a research piece on his therapy that he developed. For those of you who don't know, Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist and a neurosurgeon who served several internments in the camps of the Holocaust. He served time in Auschwitz and Dachau in particular. And when he was in the camps, he was as a prisoner, you know, and you could think or you could understand, you know, the mentality of an Auschwitz prisoner, you know, like suicide in many circumstances, you could reason would be, you know, preferable to living inside a place where you were being abused to such a horrible degree. Same thing with the gulags in Russia. I'm reading in conjunction with Frankl. I'm also reading The Gulag Archipelago, in which he talks about that, the urge to commit suicide in such a horrible prison environment where you were subject to, you know, torment and abuse, and you were inevitably going to die anyways. In both circumstances, you were more likely to die than you were to live. But despite the horrible circumstances, like, for instance, in Viktor Frankl's case, he noted that despite how bad it was in the camps, you could still find meaning and purpose for your life. You still had a reason to live in that sense. And he notes there are two cases in particular where he sort of implements this new type of therapy that he's going to invent later on, which is called logotherapy or logos therapy. So the Greek word logos or logo is akin to purpose or meaning, and therapy is, you know, the obvious sense of the word, that intervention of a psychologist is to help, like, well, therapy has a multiplicity of reasons. You could have multiplicity of definitions or applications, I should say. You could have physical therapy or mental therapy, and you could have, and so anyways, basically it's just the intervention. Logotherapy is the intervention in which you try to excite one's will to meaning. You try to give them purposes to live for, essentially. Not always is it to live for. Some people come with what Viktor Frankl deems as the reason for all pathology is the existential vacuum, and we all have this vacuum within us to some degree, and for some people it sucks in their whole identity and it makes them, you know, depressed or suicidal, and for some it's just a nagging inability to get up in the morning and go to work every day, and it manifests itself in, you know, mild to moderate depression, anxiety, you know, etc. Those are like sort of the trademark existential disorders, you know. And so anyways, you know, Frankl, while he's in the camps, he's trying to find a reason to live. You know, he's trying to find this, you know, logos, this purpose, something that could prevent the inmates from committing suicide, and not only the inmates, but something which could eventually be turned into a practice to help, you know, even the moderate businessman, or, you know, the single mother of two, or, you know, that could be something that would bolster the individual regardless of circumstance. He was looking for sort of like a universal principle to act upon, or universal, like, treatment that could be applicable to anybody. And what's important about that is, you know, he eventually sort of discovers it. We found that, you know, if you can give someone meaning and purpose in their life, they're significantly less likely to commit suicide. And on top of that, there was this one study done on 700 paralyzed patients in the Philippines, and they found that people who were in extremely adverse circumstances, such as being completely paralyzed, and these paralytics had the added disadvantage of being in chronic pain. So not only were they paralyzed, but they were also in excruciating pain most of the time, most of their waking hours. And they found that administering logotherapy exclusively increased rates of meaning and purpose within 93% to 94%. I believe it was 93.75% of all their patients. And so meaning and purpose in life is a very powerful protective and preventative factor. It's one of the most significant variables that you can adjust to prevent suicide, depression, anxiety, etc. And essentially, you know, Frankl thought that if life had meaning at all, it will have meaning in suffering. If it has meaning at the highest points, it should have meaning at the lowest points. Meaning should be ubiquitous. It should be cross categories. And so he has these two inmates that he's dealing with, that he's talking with, that he's essentially administering therapy or logotherapy, but he didn't have the term for it at the time. And one of them, or they both rather, shared the same sentiment, a sentiment that I myself has I've heard from many people in just my short years on earth. Like, life has nothing more to give me. I have nothing to get out of life, you know. And the Auschwitz prisoner has more reason to say this than most people. He has more reason to say it than the investment banker. He has more reason to say it than the 16-year-old high school student. Like, he has all the reasons in the world to hate his life. And Frankl essentially says, well, that may be true, but life has yet something to take from you. You know, you have something to give life. It's not the case. It's less about that you're trying to extract whatever you can from life, and more that life is trying to extract from you whatever it can, and that there are some responsibilities out there that you are accountable for. And so, after speaking with him for a little while, he finds that one prisoner had family that had escaped Germany and made it to the Americas. And he says, look, you know, live for your family, live to see them another day. You know, like, that's your purpose. Your purpose is now external to you. It's not focused on you. It's not egocentric or selfish in that sense. It's you're living for the cause of other people. You're living for, you know, so that you can show up and your family can be happy that you are alive, you know. And the other man was, I believe, a scientist, and he had worked out particular theories which had not yet been published. And so he said, it's now your duty to make it through these camps and publish your works. You have no other option, you know? Like, it's your responsibility to bring that to bear to further our scientific knowledge. Like, it's the most important thing you can do. And both, or rather, neither ended up committing suicide, as far as we know. And the way that you know, he talks about suicide in the camps, the way it was committed was by running into the wires there. The barbed wire was electrically charged, and if you ran into it, you would die, or you would get shot if you made it somehow to the other side of it. So either way, you would end up with your goal. And so I guess I've kind of gone on a bit of a tangent here, but it seems that, and I don't mean to say that everyone is in the same position as the Auschwitz prisoner. I'm only suggesting that right now, with the rise of suicide mental illness, that we could eventually perceive ourselves to be in similar circumstances to the Auschwitz prisoner. And that's, you know, no, I don't believe that we should willingly subject ourselves to that circumstance, you know. Insofar as your suffering is voluntary, you should strive to end it. You shouldn't suffer needlessly. You know, there's plenty of opportunity to suffer without you doing it to yourself, essentially. You know, like, if you live 80, 90 years, you know, the odds that you're going to suffer not by your own doing are incredibly high. So you don't really need to add any more to your plate in that sense. You know, and so, like, in the case of mental illness, if you are suffering from mental illness and there's a potential remedy, let's say, it's your obligation to seek that out, to get the help you need, and to get beyond the that suffering, you know, so that you can enact your purpose or you can actualize yourself. Essentially, you know, Frankl didn't quite believe in self-actualization, but, like, you can at least be on the road to actualizing yourself. Like, you may not actually become yourself in that sense, your ideal self, the self at which you, like, if you sit down and think for, you know, 5, 10 minutes, what could I be if I had everything that I needed? You know, what could I be if I had all the information I needed, if I had all the assets I needed, if I had all the time I needed? Like, if you had everything that you think you need, what would you be, you know, essentially? And that's your ideal self, and that's what you strive towards. I don't, from my understanding, I don't think Frankl thought that you could attain your ideal self, and I don't think that you can attain it either personally, but you can aspire to it. It's something that you can aim towards and move progressively. You can, provided you know what the goal is, you know how close you're getting to it, you know. I know how far it is from here to the nearest McDonald's, and therefore, you know, I know, like, I can mark my progression towards there. Every step gets me, you know, 0.5% or whatever, you know. And so if you know what your ideal self is, you can get there, you know, even if it's just, you know, 1% a year, you can still aim yourself in that direction and be shaped or approximate your ideal self. And so, but I guess back to this idea that we're all suffering from mental disorders at a disproportionate rate or at an increased rate, especially due to COVID. I think that this has given a lot of people an opportunity, those people in particular who for whatever reason have the makeup and resiliency to not suffer in this capacity. It gives them the opportunity to become essentially therapists, like therapists of old, because there's also a shortage of psychotherapists, and there's also like the problem of insurance and payment. You know, in for the most part, in therapy, unless it's complete like subsidized or whatever, most people won't do it. It's very expensive, you know, and that's a real shame because it's very beneficial. You know, there was this one landmark study, I believe it was done in the 80s or something like that, that said that people who attended therapy were 80% off, or 80% of people who attended therapy were better off than people who didn't, you know. And so that's a very powerful statistic, you know, that most people are better off if they go to therapy. And the problem is the availability of therapy. And that's a whole, you know, that's a whole separate issue. That's, you know, that's an issue of healthcare and regulation and, you know, and sort of like economics and things like that, things that are far outside my scope of understanding, though I have dealt with the insurance system quite a lot over the past year and caring for my father. There are just a lot of pitfalls there, you know, and so therapy isn't going to be available to everybody. But what is available to everybody, you know, is everyone else, right? So, like, there are individuals in each of our lives in which you could confide in. You know, most people have at least one friend, you know, and that's important because your friend, in past times, like the community was your therapist, essentially. We find that a lot of the, so there are like necessary and sufficient conditions for therapy. What a necessary condition for therapy, there are three of them. And Carl Rogers, the father of humanistic psychotherapy, kind of hit on this. It's positive regard, unconditional positive regard, genuineness, unconditional positive regard, and empathy or understanding. And so, like, if you have those three characteristics, you can be very effective in therapy. Like, you need at least those three characteristics as a therapist to be effective. If you lack empathy, if you lack unconditional positive regard, which is essentially like, even if the person in front of you tells you horrible things, you make a promise to them essentially that you're not going to react in revulsion and disgust. And if you do, you're genuine and you're authentic in your response to that. So, like, if someone says, you know, abuse so-and-so, or I have thoughts of killing such-and-such, right? Like, you do have, depending on where those statements go and, like, how that session works out, you may have a duty to report either the individual in harm or who has the potential to be harmed or who was harmed. You may have a duty to report to the authorities on some of those cases. And that would be something that you would also let your client know beforehand, obviously, but you don't reject them outright, essentially, so that they can have what would be considered a corrective emotional experience, essentially. Like, so for instance, if you lived with a mother who invalidated you your whole life, and you're used to being invalidated based off of your, maybe you'd always tell your mom, oh, I'm depressed, you know, I'm very, very sad, and you likely, you know, it's very probably you could have been very sad. Most people are depressed at least at one point in their life. And so, and she would always say, oh, no, you're just, you know, it's just your time of the month, or it's just, you know, whatever. Like, you know, she just dismisses it every time, right? So, and you go into therapy, the therapist has the potential to give you what's called a corrective emotional experience. So you say, you know, you express your feelings, and instead of the therapist dismissing them, they validate them. And that's very powerful for people. That was something that Freud came up with, I believe, is that idea that you can rectify those negative past emotions and through one positive emotion in the present. You know, I think it was quite succinctly summed up in the phrase that one moment of beauty cures, works backward over all those ugly moments, essentially. Or C.S. Lewis put it in a more theological way. He said, one moment of of heaven works back to make all life heaven, and one moment of hell makes all works back throughout life to make all life hell, you know. And so, yeah, so I think the average man will become, you know, the therapist. I know my mom is a hairdresser, and she's told me stories about just people breaking down in her chair while wearing the mask and like doing following all the COVID regulations after the opening up, and people like she quite literally said, "I've become a therapist," essentially, you know. And so I think that most people have that opportunity. Every person who has a friend has an opportunity to be a therapist, and all the necessary conditions for therapy are conditions in which a friend should share. And if your friends don't have those characteristics, well, you should maybe reevaluate that friendship, and maybe they're more of an acquaintance rather than a friend, capital F, you know. Like, and well, in that sense, you know, like, I guess now would be a good time, better than ever, to sort of place your relationships in a hierarchy, you know, like based off of how well you know them and, you know, their willingness and characteristics to do certain things to help you or to at least listen to you, or, you know, like what capacity do they interact with you? Are they, you know, friend capital F? Are they friend lowercase? Are they acquaintances? Are they just passerbys, essentially? You know, and like you may come to find after some reflection that many of the people who you thought were friends in your life are no longer, like, either maybe they're not friends. Like, when I say friend capital F, I mean like friend who would pick you up from the police station at 1 in the morning, or like, you know, they would tow your, you know, pick you up from the mechanic, or they would, you know, get lunch with you on a whim, or they would go on a camping trip with you, that kind of thing. Like, they're willing to kind of do more. They're almost in that familial capacity. They almost act as if they were your brother, your sister. You know, they act in this very knitted capacity almost. They may use phrases like "I love you," you know, like if, when there's love between friends, that's a very powerful friendship indeed, you know. And then there are also like the romantic relationships. There's like dating partners, and there's boyfriend girlfriend, and then there's, you know, fiance or serious partner, and then there's like married couples. Beyond that, or at the height of the what we call relationship hierarchy. You know, and so look for those people who are your friend, capital F, you know, to confide in, to, you know, express your feelings to. And like, you know, another big thing, another cornerstone, like a tenet of therapy, if you will, is within cognitive therapy anyways, is this idea that noticing your 9/10 of the law is essentially noticing your behavior. You know, so for instance, if you're depressed or anxious, like you can keep like a thought record, basically. You can write down on paper all of your anxious thoughts, all of your, you know, illogical cognitions, like essentially, and you can work through them. You know, like the cognitive therapists think that illogical thinking is, or illogical cognitions are the basis of all psychopathology. So long as you're thinking illogically, you will experience, you know, psychological distress, essentially. And so the way that you rectify that is by thinking logically. And the way that you think logically is by disputing or challenging your illogical thoughts and beliefs, essentially. And so the way you can do that, the best way to do that is by noticing them, by writing them down and then disputing them. You know, I think that nobody likes me. Write that down. Does nobody like, is it true that no one likes you? Well, it's probably not true that there's not one person in the world that does not like you. Do you have a dog? Do you have a cat? Do you have a boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, friend, son, whatever, you know, like husband, like all you need to refute that claim is one single person that loves you. And I think that if you go looking for it, you may find at least one person that loves you. Even Charlie Manson, that horrible mass murderer or serial killer, had people who loved him. You know, you're not completely unlovable. And so essentially you go down that list. And that, in that sense, you can be your own therapist. The cognitive therapists are really trying to make you your own therapists so that they can terminate therapy with you, which is why cognitive therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy in particular has been on the rise, because it, in that sense, it's more like regular medicine. It seeks to have some sort of moment at which you're healed. Now, you could argue that, like, in the pharmacology industry, like the big, you know, big pill box medicine stores aren't interested in you being healthy, and there's a lot of good reasons that you might believe that, you know, what with like prescription rates and, you know, the cost of these prescriptions and the types of prescriptions and what they do for you. A lot of them could be, you know, fixed without being prescribed to you, like a lot of the disorders that are being, at least in, like, okay, so for instance, we know that essentially, getting up off the couch and facing your fears, those are like the two most powerful things you can do, therapeutic things you can do to help with depression and anxiety. And what I mean by that is exercise is one of the most powerful protective and preventative factors for depression and anxiety and most mental illness in general. And facing your fears through the form that, the technical term is basically called exposure therapy, right? And that's literally where you literally, you just are exposed to what you are afraid of. And you can do this gradually. You can form what's called an anxiety hierarchy, and you can do it incrementally, or you can do it all at once, right? So you can, let's say you're afraid of, you're an agoraphobic and you're afraid of leaving your house. Okay. You could develop an anxiety hierarchy, and you could say, it scares me to step onto my front porch, but it doesn't scare me as much as going to the mall. And going through a drive-through is more scary than going to my porch, but less scary than going to the mall. And so now you have, you know, the porch is the least scary. The drive-through is slightly more scary than that, but most scary of all is the mall. And so you work your way up. You say, all right, 3 times a day, I'm going to step out on my porch. Okay. And like, you can do this with relaxation techniques, because another thing that's important to know is you actually can't have a panic attack while you're relaxing. If you're actually relaxing, that is. Some people say that my state of relaxation is a panic attack. And well, you know, that's just obviously a joke, you know, because when you're in an actual state of relaxation, mentally quiet and you're somatically quiet, that is, like, you're not fidgeting, you're not like vibrating, basically. Like, if you've ever seen anyone who's panicking, they sometimes literally just jitter uncontrollably. You can't have a panic attack in a totally relaxed state. You can move from relaxation to an anxious state, but while you're in that relaxed state, you can't be having a panic attack. And so what a lot of people accompany with exposure therapy is relaxation training. And so essentially what that means is you go out, you know, while you're on the porch, maybe you have that thing, this might be a bad idea, but just for the sake of example, maybe donuts, maybe like when you're having a cherry donut, like that's very therapeutic for you in that sense that it calms you down and relaxes you. You know, maybe it does that because, like, when you were a kid, the way your mom calmed you down was they gave you, you know, she gave you sweets or, you know, cherry candies or whatever. And that kind of developed into this relationship with cherry donuts. Now, this could be bad, obviously. Like, you don't want to overeat as a means to calming yourself. This is how you get eating disorders, you know, that you associate food with comfort, right? But you find something that calms you down, and you do that thing while you're on the porch. Maybe you read a book while you're on the porch or something like that. You do something that calms you down while you're doing the thing that scares you, right? And so they found that this type of therapy, and you do this, you can do this gradually, and you can also do it all at once. It really depends on how bold you are, essentially. You know, like I used to do this myself. I have social anxiety. I would go to places where there would be a lot of people and that I would be forced to interact with them. Like, so instead of going through the drive-thru, I would go in and order my food, which is very difficult for me at the time. You know, and so like, and that's like common sense stuff, right? Get off your butt and face your fears. Like, those are very common sense statements. And to me, it actually, I find it a little bit frustrating that those two things are so effective, because they're so common sense. Like, in fact, in previous times, people thought that would be callous to say to someone. Even now, if I said that to somebody, they'd be like, oh, you don't understand me. It's like, well, no, actually, what the data shows is that people with your exact disorder, people with anxiety, depression, and these types of disorders benefit greatly from exercise and facing their fears, you know? And so, and this kind of, that could also be used as like this slight to the, you know, pharmacology, right? Psychopharmacology, right? Like being, so exercise and facing your fears, those types of things, those are actually more effective than the drugs are, basically, at least for depression, you know? So going to therapy and doing your homework, like doing what the therapist assigns you to do in your daily life, is more effective, or at least as effective as the drugs that they would give you to manage your depression, generally speaking. There are, of course, instances that the medicine, that people do need medicine, you know, like there are people who, in many cases, the medicine helps you to do those things, you know, like if you take anti-anxiety medication, like your anxiety may be so bad that you pass out every time you leave your house. And in that case, you can't actually work to face your fears because you're crippled in that sense, you know? So the medication gives you this leg up on the disorder in that sense. It allows you to at least make the step to face your fears. So back to this idea of, you know, the everyday man being a therapist, you know, there are a lot of, I would say that in general, we're a more empathetic society than maybe 100 years ago, just by the virtue of our awareness of everything, you know, like we live in the age of information and we're bombarded with, you know, facts and data points and opinions, and, you know, we sort of have become aware, and awareness is one of the cornerstones of empathy, one of those necessary conditions for effective therapy, right? And so having that information or having that understanding of the condition, like if you are one of those who, for whatever reasons, have what's called like a neurotypical mind, you know, you're just, you have nothing, you have no neurosis, you have no psychopathology, right? Like, it may be difficult for you to understand what it's like to help someone who has depression, anxiety, suicidal tendencies. And by the way, if you are struggling with suicidal tendencies, there are many fine, free institutions through the suicide hotline, which will be in the comments wherever this is posted, for you to call and talk with someone. And talking, again, is one of those common sense things that actually helps. You know, if you just sit and talk with someone, especially someone who understands you and has those other, you know, that unconditional positive regard, empathy, and genuineness, like they genuinely, you can tell they genuinely care and are interested in your story, you know, that you can be helped. You know, it's not impossible. The Auschwitz inmate was able to stave off threat of suicide, and he had every reason, and you may have every reason to as well, but it's simply not the answer. There are other answers. There are other alternatives and ways of being, and there are things that can undoubtedly help you. And, you know, there are lots of, especially now in time of pandemic, like maybe you don't have access to your friends, you know, maybe you were a college student and you lived on campus and now you live at home with your parents and your parents are terrible and they dismiss everything you say and they condescend to you and they just generally have little empathy or understanding of you and your condition. And all of your support group was in college, you know, I would encourage you to reach out to them or, you know, because, well, you know, maybe it's very possible that they were your only support group. And so it's, if you're feeling down, that would be one thing that could certainly help, is reaching out to those who were your primary network, that primary, you know, protective and preventative group, that network or shield, essentially, from all those horrible things that run around in your head. You know, maybe you have a friend who every time, you know, they can just tell, you know, like, oh man, he's really not thinking very well of himself, you know, like, and they can either joke with you or, you know, it's really the smallest things that matter a lot. And a lot of people report that, you know, like when you get into a therapeutic setting or a therapy setting rather, like, people will talk about the smallest, most random things that either deeply impacted them in a negative way or positively impacted them. You know, there was one, I was reading a therapy book by this one legendary psychotherapist. His name is Irvin Yalom, and he contributed a lot to the field of like group therapy and existential psychology. He talked about this, there was this one patient he had who was terminally ill, and he, in the course of talking with her, he found that she had one single transformative event that happened in her time as a cancer patient, and he had been working with her for a while, and she was just insufferable for the most part. Like, she was just very, just a very unpleasant person, and he was just not able to work with her. He, you know, like, there was not, like, just kept shooting past each other, essentially, until she was in one of her chemo treatments or something like that, and was in the hospital bed, and all of her family was there visiting her, despite how, you know, awful she had been. And you may think that, you know, people who are in terminal circumstances are allowed to be awful, but one thing it's important to remember, like, if you're suffering in particular, like, just because you are in pain does not mean you get to be a pain, you know. I had that conversation with my dad a lot, and my dad, you know, well, he incurred a traumatic brain injury, you know, and it's like, yes, like, what you're going through is one of the worst things that you can go through, but it doesn't mean that you get to make everyone else's life equally as bad or bad in general because your life is bad. You know, you don't get to be a black hole. You know, you don't get to suck everyone else down with you. That privilege is not afforded to you, you know. And so anyways, she's being terrible in her bed, and this nurse whispers in her ear, essentially something like, pull it together, do it for them, or something like that. And then she just, for whatever reason, like, a switch went off in her head, and she was, you know, she wasn't terrible anymore. She was, in fact, she became wonderful, you know, like, she stopped being so awful, essentially, for the rest of her life. So long as she lived, her life was completely changed for the better. And there was just like six words whispered in her ear. Now, this kind of steps into another domain because, well, it also matters how we interpret those events. You know, like, she could have taken that, to mean something very, very, negative. You know, she could have been, you know, why would you tell me that? You're a nurse, get out of here. That's something you shouldn't, you shouldn't talk about, or you shouldn't, that's overstepping your boundaries. And she could have lashed out at the nurse. So the nurse in that sense took a risk. And so that's also, so that's a common cognitive distortion, actually, is mind reading. People assume that you know what you're thinking. So if I said, "Oh, that's a very nice watch you have there," and they would say, "Are you insulting me? Like, what do you mean that's a nice watch? Like, I think it's a nice watch, but why would you say it like that?" And it's like, no, I literally mean it's a nice watch. Like they're inferring or transferring motives onto me. You may have also heard the term projection. It's like if you're angry, you're likely to think the person across from you is angry. Or if you're sad, likewise, you might think the person across from you is sad or something. Like it's not quite one-to-one. Like you may project on any number of emotions given your own emotions, you know, like if you want to feel small and insignificant, you may project this condescending tone into everyone's voice, essentially. And so that everyone who talks to you, they sound like they're condescending towards you. And so mind reading is a cognitive distortion, and it's a common one. Most people fall prey to it. But provided you can reason through it, like if this, the patient in Irv's book, she didn't suffer from mind reading. If she had, she might not have benefited from those few words from the patient. And likewise, if she had asked what the nurse was really meaning, she would have found that the nurse was actually trying to insult her. Because as you find later in the book, this nurse, and this, so if you do plan to read this book, the book is called Love's Executioner, I believe. And if not, I'll link the right book in the description and you'll be able to find that. But, you'll find, so I am going to spoil this one story just for sake of illustration. The nurse actually ends up as a patient of Irv's, and he finds this out and makes the connection. And these are all based off his real life clinical work or real life patients. And he finds that this nurse was the nurse for the patient that had this major turnaround, and he finds out that this is the same nurse that said those words. And she said, and he relayed all this information with like the what would you say, consent of the person. So he had like written consent to release a lot of her information, obviously because he wrote a story about her. And so he told the nurse, you know, what did you know. When you like, what did you say? How did you say it? Like, why did you say what you said to her? And she said, I wasn't trying to be nice. I was berating her because she was acting like a child. I was, you know, I was angry with her. And I didn't whisper it. I hissed it. I hissed, snap up, do it for them. And so that's that actually, that's kind of like another, I guess that's sort of like another point, you know, like not only do you not know what the other person is thinking, but they also may be, you know, two people experiencing the same thing, maybe experiencing two completely different things, you know, and so like interpretations do matter, but also like there is an objective reality underlying the entire event, you know, there is a realness to what happened, you know, like apart from interpretations. But cognitions are the way that we interpret our events, you know, and those are important. And the more objective those interpretations are, the cognitive psychologists speculate the less psychopathology there'll be, you know. So the more logical, the more objective, and more true to reality your thoughts are, the less likely you're to suffer from, you know, any form of neurotic behavior. And yeah, I guess I kind of went on a tangent, and this episode is coming up on 40, 45 minutes. I feel that this is I could cut it here, and I could continue on in another episode if you found anything you listened to here interesting at all. Yeah, please leave a comment below or email me. I'd love to hear what you think, or if anything here helped you, or if you found something I said here offensive, or you want me to elaborate more on a point, you can just leave a comment and just let me know, you know, what you'd like to hear, or if you need an apology, I'd be willing to offer that as well. So, yeah, thanks for watching.
Thanks for taking the time to watch this episode of Will Work for Purpose. If you found anything here interesting, you can always leave a comment below or email me at mosley@tweakingo.com. If you were watching this podcast on YouTube, you can find audio versions of it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else major podcasts are found. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.